netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this episode, Mike talks with production side VFX supervisor Kevin Lingenfelser about the visual effects for the Netflix series Man on Fire. And one of the things I like about many of Mike's interviews is that instead of covering a lot of different visual effects, he focuses the conversation on a few areas. In this case, the complex apartment tower scenes and the Learjet runway attack sequence. I think it's really great to get a lot more detail on fewer things as you really start to understand the work done on the series. Kevin discusses working with vendors including Rise, SSVFX, Barnstorm, and Mr. Wolf on these sequences. But before we listen to that, a quick sidebar. For those of you that are listening to this FX podcast, I want to remind you that we also have a video version of it available on YouTube. You can find a link in the article and subscribe to get notified when we have new episodes. With that out of the way, let's go ahead and cross the conversation now.
Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. I'm looking forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Hey, so when did you first get involved with Man on Fire?
Let's see, it would have been around, if memory serves me right, it was around May of 2024. I was kind of coming off of like 15 months of like no work due to the strikes. You know, I'd been trying and stuff like that, but it, you know, it was a hard time at that point. Everybody was trying. So, you go for a show and, you know, like with Man of Fire, I found out that, I think after I got it, there was like 8 to 10 other people that were interviewed for it. So, it was Netflix who just contacted me and told me about it. I wasn't aware that they were doing any kind of reboot. And then he told me who was involved and whatnot. And then, they set up an interview and, the interview was with, the showrunner Kyle Killen and then, the Block One director, Stephen Cable Jr. And then, several producers, EPs on the show. And then, the show also had two other production companies. There was the Chernin Group, and then there was New Regency involved with it as well. So there were some producers from both camps on the call as well. So it was about 10 people on that call. So, and then they, you know, you do these things and, you know, you, at the end of it, you hope that you feel good about it. And they're like, yeah, you know, and then you wait to see. And, I just remember with that call, me and Steven kind of vibing and gelling pretty well, you know. So.
Which is so important, isn't it? Like, yeah. That's just critical.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. I mean, a lot of this, you know, I found out through the years, they do hire a lot of times on, you know, based on personality and how people interact. So it's definitely crucial. And him and I just got to talking about what his visual effects experience was, having done Creed 2 and Transformers Rise of the Beasts. So I was able to talk to him at length about it. So he was well aware of visual effects and, you know, what could be done and what, you know, and how it could service the show.
So you said Block 1. How many blocks were there?
There were 4 blocks, and it was originally 8 episodes, but during the course of, it wasn't really until post where it was decided that they wanted to combine episodes 7 and 8, which was Block 4. And I think it was for the best because I think there were concerns about 7 possibly dragging a bit, and they didn't want that obviously for the final episode. Cause you know, usually with these things or with most shows, it's like, Block 1, the first 2 episodes usually have a lot going on visual effects wise.
I was going to exactly discuss that. Yeah, that real need to establish
right. That
the audience is kind of hooked and to give the scope of the production. Yeah, that Block 1 is increasingly becoming incredibly visually effects heavy. And then I think you're about to go on and discuss block four, sorry.
Yeah, and then usually what happens is you get several episodes, like 3 and 4 will be lighter on the visual effects, and then it'll start to ramp up somewhere around 6 and 7 and 8. In our case, 6 had some stuff, and then 7 was lighter, and then 8, everything was ratcheted up there because that was obviously the, you know, the climax of the series, and all these storylines had to be kind of wrapped up.
Well, let's discuss block one for two reasons, right? Firstly, because I don't want to give away what happens at the end. But secondly, there is a lot of really good stuff. And I'd love to, rather than discuss everything that you did, just drill in on two things if I could, which is the apartment block collapse and the plane attack sequence with the on the runway. So the whole thing about the apartment block is this wasn't like a shot that came along out of the blue. We had seen that apartment block a lot before the destruction of the apartment block. So I'm guessing that you had to do a bunch of seamless visual effects, or did you have an actual apartment block that looked just like that and you just happened to model it seamlessly so I couldn't tell when you'd move between real and digital?
No, those two buildings, because basically what it was two identical buildings that we created, that Rise effects created for us. And it was based on an actual structure in Bosque Real, Mexico. It was about, I want to say it was a 40-story, very affluent condominium type complex building. So it was kind of based on a pre-existing building, but we didn't use that building for any exterior shots. Actually, they filmed interiors there in that same building in Mexico. But anytime you saw the Rayburn condo, as it was called, and its sister building, those were CG as done by Rise. They just had to be integrated into our Rio plates because the story takes place in Brazil entirely, but the majority of the filming occurred in Mexico, which doubled really effectively for Rio. And we can get into, you know, what we had to do. We had to be very careful of Spanish signage and making sure that, you know, we had to account for Portuguese and that type of thing.
It's a bit of a magic trick, isn't it? Because it's like to have the building collapse, we have to, and for it to be as it does working so well in the story, you have to kind of see it. But then all those previous shots can't possibly hint at the fact that it's digital. Otherwise, you know, we know what's coming, and also it would ruin the effect.
Correct.
So you've got a whole lot of sort of, for no other reason than sort of story, a whole lot of visual effect shots to do, which don't do anything other than allow you to do the spectacular stuff that happens near the end of that sequence.
Exactly. That, I think that coupled with the fact that I don't think anyone saw the Bobby Cannavale Rayburn character getting killed off in the first episode. You know, that
no, that was that's a Hitchcock psycho kind of touch, that one. Kill off a main character early at when you're like, no, what?
Yes.
Yeah, no, that does catch you off guard tremendously. I was also thinking in the destruction sequence, how you had to have choreographed the destruction really well because for the staging of it, his daughter is at the front of the building. If the building had fallen even slightly forwards, you'd expect her to be dead, or at least completely like, you know, kind of unable to talk, which would defeat the next whole sort of part of the narrative.
Pretty much negates the entire premise of the series. So no, exactly. It was, we were always cognizant of that, of like how close can Poe reasonably get to it where the audience and we as well would believe that she survived what had occurred. And interestingly enough, when we were devising the destruction of the building, I had been looking at all sorts of demolition footage, real world demolition, and globally, you know, various different countries and how they destroyed their structures, building structures. Obviously, there were a lot in Vegas. Most of them are done, obviously, during the day. Vegas likes to do theirs at night for spectacle. So I was looking at stuff like that and how involved and how the math involved in bringing a building down safely. So we went down that road. But then it was, you know, the showrunner, Kyle, who basically was like, no, actually, this needs to be messy. This needs to be chaotic because this is.
Yeah, the people that are blowing up weren't trying to do it safely. That was exactly the exact opposite intent.
So then we looked at some real world instances of, and once again, globally, of housing projects, buildings and structures like that being destroyed in various wars. And obviously there was none of those. It was always aftermath type footage. There was no footage of the actual bombs themselves going off. So we were looking at things like that. And that's why we came up with this idea of like having the initial blast at the lobby ground floor level, and then having another blast about mid height that kind of segments the building. And then that ensures that the building falls backwards away from her. But we still get that, obviously, whenever a building collapses, whether it's clean or dirty or whatever, there is just a massive amount of dust that is kicked up from all.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, obviously not being in any way disrespectful to what happened, but I think in the zeitgeist of any audience, the most prominent building coming down is what happened at 9/11. And I would say pre-9/11, and again, I'm not being disrespectful to what happened, but
right. Just
in terms of people's understanding, it used to be that things sort of blew up. And it was only, I think, after 9/11 that we all became immediately aware that it's not so much a flame cloud that engulfs everyone. It's a dust cloud.
Yes.
And obviously those images are so significant that they're kind of now the touch point that everybody kind of has in their minds.
Now you bring up a good point. And
you sort of want the explosion that lovely sort of gold. Lovely is a horrible thing to say. But you know what I mean? Like that rich orangey, you want that because it's visually terrific. And a gray dust cloud isn't as visually dramatic, but it's that dust cloud that sort of dominates our thinking, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And both vendors, both Rise and then Screen Scene Visual Effects, did the sequence right after, which was the aftermath. And in both cases, we looked at those photographs from 9/11 specifically to get a good sense of like, okay, how much dust, how much embers and dust should be floating in the air, how much dust should be covering, you know, objects and cars and things like that. Minimize minimize the fire aspect of it. You know, basically the only fire we kind of introduced was this idea that gas lines would have been ruptured and they may still be emitting and they were ignited, that type of thing. But otherwise we tried once the building actually did collapse, as seen in Rise's shot, and then going to the aftermath sequence that SS did, you know, it was about pretty much looking at those photos, using those as reference, you know, as hard as it was to kind of like look at that stuff. And we didn't emulate anything specifically, but it was.
No, of course. But I mean, that's what we now believe would be what would happen if a building goes down.
Right.
Like it's just how the world now sees that, in the same way that, you know, you kind of any other tragedy just is so dominant in our thinking that it just influences what you would expect to be real.
Right.
Hey, how much did you get? So just going back now to the collapsing. So the building halfway up does this kind of break in the middle thing that you just mentioned before. In terms of doing that, though, that's like a destruction sim. It's not, you know, hand animated, of course. So how much direction and ability to direct did you feel you had in these sims? Was it a matter of just doing loads of sims until you got one that kind of looked like you wanted, or could you really get in there and art direct it with the tools that you had available to you?
Well, thankfully, we didn't art direct it. We pretty much were happy. Rise did do numerous sims, you know, and they would show us along the way. and their supervisor, Andreas, was very good about, like, I know there were many more Sims that they did than before I even saw anything. So by the time they were showing us stuff, it was looking pretty good, and it was maintaining the kind of believability, and it was doing the right thing, like I said, in sense of falling realistically and falling away from where Poe was. And it nothing about it looked forced. It was all, once again, sim-wise. So we really didn't go in and art direct anything about. The only real specific art direction we did was kind of like to tie into what SSVFX was doing with the sequence right after, where at the very end, we've, you know, Creasy has made this long walk to get to where the building was, and it's revealed to be just, you know, mangled metal and concrete and beams and everything, and pockets of the fire that I mentioned. So what we had Rise do is on the very last shot where the building kind of collapses and then it's overcome by the dust cloud, we added this bit of interactive orange glow within that to kind of tie into what SSVFX did in later shots.
And the ground shot, her point of view, looking at her father dying with the car rolling and all that kind of stuff, presumably there was some kind of like digital handoff between what was obviously the real actor and I presume was a digital double, or was it just clever?
That was such a quick shot. No, we were able to actually achieve that with just Billy, the actress playing Poe, on a ratchet that we just, you know, she was kind of pulled out of frame really quickly. So we were able to achieve that. And then the two cars near the lobby area, those were actually on SFX flippers that the SFX team had devised and set up there. And then we did do a takeover digitally for the cars, but and then we augmented. We did film a practical explosion at that base level where the foundation is. And then Rise augmented that to spread more. And then we also played with, because once again, this was filmed at night. It was about 4:30. So it was almost accurate to the time it was supposed to occur. But the problem is whenever you photograph fire, you know, in at night, you know, you run that risk of the details getting blown out because you're exposing before the explosion happens, you're exposing for everything else. And then once that explosion goes off, you know, it tends to get blown out. So we made sure that Rise kind of went in and brought back those details within the explosion and with what was there special effects wise and what they were doing Houdini effect simulation wise to augment it.
Excellent. Well, so that's this big epic scale, obviously, bringing down entire apartment blocks. Can we jump now to the attempt to escape by a plane from the drama that's unfolding?
Yeah.
So here, I'm assuming that you don't get to shoot up actual planes, but there must have been a real plane at some point. Tell me what the mix was between digital and real. And of course, I don't think they let you fly planes with doors missing either. So I was kind of assuming at some point there was some clever stuff done.
Yeah, exactly. No, you caught that. The tarmac attack sequence, as we called it, was basically, we had this this Learjet that we rented for like a day. So basically what we did is we had a sun, I remember specifically it was a Sunday. We had time when it came in and landed at Cuernavaca Airport in Mexico. This was an airport like 2 hours away from the main airport. It was kind of interesting. It's like this brand new, you know, I forget how many years old the airport is, but it was supposed to be this overflow airport for all traffic from the main Mexico airport. And it was something one of the politicians kind of developed and had funded, and they made it, and then it wasn't used. So now it's used for like flight training and the occasional flights would come in, and we actually had to stop a couple times because of that. But anyways, so we started there, and you know, we had this Learjet come in, we scanned it with Clear Angle. Their guys came in, scanned it, you know, got it. So we had this really tight model of it. And then we had a couple of shots on the first day of the shoot where it was utilized on the runway. And then pretty much, you know, that was it. We had it for the day. And then what had happened is the art department had made a, you know, a buck version of it, which was basically just the front of the plane and about a third of it. So it had the main entryway door and it had the stairs going up and but beyond that, nothing. And attached to that.
Sorry, this thing that they built, is this thing like mobile? Because
yes, it was
the shot that I'm.
Yeah, it was attached to a truck that towed it, basically.
So because I was going to say, like, the thing that was bugging me was how you had people jumping from vehicles into a plane.
Yeah.
Because I was like, well, it's one thing if a plane is like, there's a latest shot, obviously, when the plane is over a road looking like it's going to land.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's an obviously, if I was you, I would have suggested CGI. But for those shots where you put a plane, people actually jumping in and out of it, and it's on a tarmac, and it's bull, I was like, well, it seemed really a hard ask to make that a CG thing. But by the same token, I couldn't imagine how you do it with a real one.
Yeah, that was basically what happened is for those shots where the very first instance of that is when the character Tiago, one of the terrorists, he jumps from the Jeep to the plane. So basically that was a real plate shot in Cuernavaca of the Jeep and him on a rig. And basically what happens is he actually jumps onto the open doorway of the buck. But then what happened is we then had green screen stage work where the buck was taken back to Churubusco Studios in Mexico City. And that's where we did all the interior work. So basically we did this kind of like Texas Switch thing where when he jumps from the plate to the buck, he kind of goes out of frame and then he comes up into frame. So when he comes up into frame, he's now in the green screen stage in Churubusco Studios. So we've kind of blended those two that way.
That's a good comp because I got to say, I'm normally like really suspicious of shots out a window as being like, you know, matching the right depth of field, matching the right exposure and everything else. But what you're telling me is the interior shots looking through the doorway of him coming up, all of that exterior is just from a different plate, right?
Correct. Yeah, correct. And then the camera basically, once, like I said, he jumps, he had a wire, the stuntman doing the gag, and then he falls out of frame real quickly and then he stands up. And when he stands up, it's a takeover to the stage. And then the camera whips around with him. He looks toward the cockpit that's on the stage. And we have another plate looking out the cockpit toward the airport. And then he whip pans to his right. And then he goes down the length of the passenger area.
But I don't have the shots in front of me, but in my mind, there's shots looking, I'm going to say aft past the end of the plane that establishes the car coming up towards the plane. And of course,
that's CG.
For that shot to work, you have to have wings and engines and stuff. And that engine's going to become really significant anyway in a second.
Yeah.
So that's all digital on.
Correct.
Or was the buck. Right. So the buck didn't go that far back.
No, exactly. No. Basically, what we had is once again, the art department, the production designer in the art department, they kind of had this like really. It was extremely helpful, but this really rickety structure that represented the length of the wing. So we kind of knew because that was critical because there was no way the stunt team was going to, without that, know exactly how close they can realistically get to it. So there had to be that structure there. So they knew, okay, we need to go around this thing in order to make that work. Plus the buck had a stunt truss on it that was hooked up to facilitate that jump that Tiago did.
Right.
And then the same jump that Creasy makes, his stunt double using that same truss. But the other interesting thing about the buck, just going back to it real quick, is the buck was actually built 15% larger to accommodate the fight choreography inside the cabin area and to facilitate just the camera operator. We had two main camera operators, but it was pretty much just Mitch, the Steadicam guy.
You had me on that because I didn't, until you said that, I didn't realize that that was the case. Because now I think about it, I can never stand up in those sorts of aircraft, right? Like, not that I fly in private jets, but do you know what I mean? Like, they're kind of really small, and there is fight stuff happening inside it. In fact, there's two fight sequences, right?
Yeah. It's basically, they start with the initial sequence before it starts moving. We were able to make use of the actual real jet to a point. So when we have a couple shots looking out the cockpit, when the co-pilot's there,
when the pilot's alive. Shot.
Yeah, exactly. That was like one of the few shots where we utilized the actual real Learjet. But then after that, we took over, and you had mentioned, you know, things like having the door open and the stairs down. Once the Learjet started moving, it was no go. Everything had to be up. So we actually had to then, Rise had to go in and CG the stairs and open the door on those shots. Even though it was only moving, like, not even at this point, five, once it just even started to taxi, you know, just slightly, the door was closed and the stairs were up. So we had to do that CG because there's like,
if I had a Learjet, I wouldn't want you damaging the door. That would be.
Yeah. Yeah. And then obviously all the bullet damage was us as well.
Yeah. And so you've got you've got wide exterior shots, like establishing its, you know, relationship to the, because there's multiple gun trucks coming in with machine guns on them, so we've got that choreography and I can sort of see it in the distance, but it starts taking off, and then to make matters worse, an engine dies, right? Or rather,
yeah, it gets blown,
explodes, yep. Kind of thing. So again, I'm presuming, did you have any like practical stuff for smoke or anything else that was sort of coming out of all of that, or was that all just added?
No, that was all Rise and Houdini effect simulations. And those were, the initial explosion one, was actually easier than the rest of them. Once the actual smoke was, trailing and in at great length, then you had all these other factors that affect the physics of it. You have this smoke that is, you know, billowing out of this busted engine. You have this airplane that's moving at a high speed, and then you have camera motion, and all that factored in. And some of the initial tests and renders we were getting, Houdini was having a problem kind of keeping up with the speed of things. So we would get what I would call skips, basically, like clumps of smoke within, yeah. And which just obviously didn't look very natural. So that was one of the tougher challenges after the engine blows, those shots before it takes off. And then when we see the wide master of it kind of making its way toward the two-lane road, anytime the smoke was still billowing, it just was something that Rise was just constantly on top of and making sure that it was doing the right things physics-wise and looking as photoreal as possible.
Now, they do take off, obviously, and just like missing concrete barriers and stuff, which, but notwithstanding the fact that I'm sure that that was good effects work, it was sort of like more obvious that one would be able to have tools in the toolbox to solve those problems. What I was interested in is at the other side of the barrier, they land. Now, just from a like reading it on the page point of view, it's pretty hard to get a Learjet and stick it on a country road. And yet they have to have successfully stopped it. So even though the drama is less, obviously they've now stopped it, they're getting out.
Yeah.
You still have to solve the problem of a Learjet on a highway so that they can carjack that poor guy's car and make it. So what was happening there? Presumably you didn't have anything there. You didn't truck
a jet, did you? What I did is production asked me and I said, no, you know what? Working with Steven, the director, I said, you know what? Let's have the Buck out there. Because at bare minimum, it gives me, the Buck was made entirely of wood and painted to look like metal, to the art department's credit. There was not one metal piece within that thing. So it was just a wooden structure. And once again, remember, it was 15% oversized, but I still wanted something out there to be in that physical space. So we determined the stopping point. We knew exactly where the plane was going to stop. and we set it up there and we kind of left it there. And then the rest of it was entirely CG plane, you know, and, you know, so basically what happened is the buck was removed, painted out, and then the digital version was dropped in basically with all the bullet hole damage, which has riddled that whole port side fuselage from the engine all the way up to the cockpit and the doorway and the stairs.
And the destructed sort of engine that's on that same port side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So not only were the compass doing a good job, but the roto team that was supporting them, I presume, was doing that, because none of that would have been green screen or anything, right?
I'm a big kind of believer, like when we shoot exteriors like that, I try to avoid even bringing in a green screen in unless there's a real strong need for it. Like if someone has like crazy flyaway type hairs, maybe. But even then, I'd rather not have a green screen come in and eliminate, you know, affect lighting or eliminate part of the background that we could use, even though you can rebuild it. I'm a big believer in using roto. So, and exactly, that's how that was done. So there's the shot where, you know, once Creasy and Poe jump down and Creasy's thrown Tiago on the ground, they get up and they walk toward that car. That was all roto. And you have the large, it was a long lens shot where the blade is taking up the whole frame, and that's entirely CG.
Yeah. Speaking of cars, I skipped over the bit. The vehicles, the gun trucks or whatever you want to call them that were chasing them at the thing, there's a scene where I've forgotten the make of vehicle that he's driving that he jumps out of, but then I think it careers over.
Yeah, the Montero. That's a Mitsubishi Montero. And yes, when he jumps over, what has happened is one of our stunt performance, Brett Sheeran, is actually dressed all in black and he's driving it, and he was removed for that bit.
Right. Cause then it kind of veers off and causes problems for our bad guys.
Yes.
I was wondering if there was a takeover on that, because it does look like there's no one in the vehicle.
No, and just removed from it.
I just got my hats off to those guys that do those kind of things.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's not the thing that you're most looking at, but if it wasn't done right, you would totally notice it.
Absolutely.
And freak out. Hey, you started mentioning this earlier and I didn't want to change course, but could you want to discuss the idea of shooting Mexico as your location? You're mentioning like signage and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to touch on that?
So basically, like I said, the story takes place in Brazil. But it was determined even before I came onto the show that they were going to shoot, obviously, in Mexico City. And they have great crews there. I did another film many years ago there called Get the Gringo, this Mel Gibson film. And it was, matter of fact, it was the same production company, Red Rum. So we worked with them on it. And we did do 3 weeks in Rio, which was fantastic, you know, so we could get the kind of like establishers and the favela footage that we needed, especially those exteriors that show the sheer breadth of the favela there in Rio. And then basically, we had not a lot, but any time during the course of production and then even in post, we would spot something like, there's a sign back there and it's in Spanish. So we had to get the proper.
Because I was going to say, we talked about two scenes, right? That destruction sequence and the airplane sequence. But the thing that joins those two is a rapid drive with vehicles to try and get to safety. And in that intervening, in that middle scene that happens, right, you're covering a lot of terrain that would have a lot of shops, signs and whatever. They're sort of like,
thankfully that sequence was shot there in Brazil.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, because that's like a heck of a lot of
sort
of kilometers of scenery that the team are driving through.
Steven and Hank, the stunt coordinator, they choreographed all that through those streets and several different locations in Brazil. That was one of the main things that they were there for. That had been storyboarded out and everything. So they knew coming to Brazil, they needed to get that and then several other things, obviously establishers of where the buildings would be and things of that nature, and then beach shots along Ipanema and things like that.
Because in the story at that point, they're kind of literally looking out of their vehicle trying to spot the bad guys following them. So there are lots of shots for the audience looking up streets and looking up long streets at that, because there are vehicles in running parallel. So I was thinking, man, you're just like making work for the roto team there or the... So that wasn't where you were mainly doing the digital work. So presumably it was like later in out of block one, or where was that?
Well, we would also in pretty much every episode, anytime we shot anything in Mexico City exterior wise, if we saw any signage, we would there was like one drone shot where it was up high following Mello's car. It was, and there was these warehouse buildings, and they had all this Spanish signage on them. So we had to remove all of that. That was actually just easy. It was like, okay, are we going to do translation here? Is it necessary, or do we just clean it up? And we actually, in that case, we were just able to remove them. So, which was great. And we were using like Studio 8 for that type of work for us. Which was nice. So, I mean, and then with like, in the case of the two-lane road and backing up real quick, once again, to the airport even, what had happened is the production designer Ram and his team, they took all the signage there at the Cuernavaca airport, and they did turn it over. They actually made signage in Portuguese that they put up on some of the hangars and stuff like that. There was like a couple of other signs that we got rid of over the course of the sequence, but that helped. And then when the plane lands on the two-lane road, there's a couple of signs indicating the name of the road, that type of thing. That was also replaced with Portuguese signage by the art department.
And presumably number plates were production design, just swapping plates on, because you would have controlled all of those vehicles around.
Yes, as far as I, yeah, exactly. As far as I know, yeah, that was all, exactly. That was all handled by production.
We started discussing work that Rise did. Maybe you could just run through the vendors that you worked with.
Sure. So
you mentioned a few, but
basically it started with, I knew kind of like I hired Rise after seeing their work on the opening of Fallout with the nuclear bombs going off in LA, and they had building.
It's nice work there.
Yeah, exactly. And they had building destruction in there. I'm like, okay. And then SSVFX, I had worked with them on Shadow and Bone seasons 1 and 2. That's how I came to kind of know them or find them when I was working with Ted Ray. So I knew I wanted to get them on this as well. And then from there, we used Mr. Wolf, who I'd used for a while now as well. And they helped us out on several sequences. And then even Barnstorm came in and did 2 sequences for us in episode 8, which ended up being 7. There's a sequence in the final episode where Tappan is looking, he's on a balcony overlooking the city, and it's supposed to be Rio. That was shot on the 14th floor of a hotel in Mexico City. And there was no discussion that that was going to be visual effects. But when I saw the footage, I'm like, well, this really isn't Rio. Haven't been there now. I was like, okay, this doesn't really look like Rio. Can we? And there was discussions back and forth. Can we do it? So we shot plates in Rio. Hank, our stunt coordinator, second unit director, did that for me. And we basically replaced all those backgrounds. And that was another example of all roto. And that was done by Barnstorm. And I don't think most people will realize we've done that work. And then just to kind of also talk about real quickly, just how things pop up over the course of production and how things kind of get turned around and whatnot. There was a sequence at the end where Poe is held captive by Suarez at gunpoint. And she was in, both her and Creasy are wearing like these kind of greenish scrubs. Mm-hmm. Well, for that sequence, when they shot it, basic what happened is she ended up in a new pair of clean scrubs, but in the sequence before the hand grenade had gone off and there was all this dirt and all this stuff. And if you look at shots of her, she is relatively filthy. So that was a discussion as well. It was like, okay, do we need to basically dirty her scrubs and, you know, dirty her face up as well? And ultimately it was determined, okay, we're going to do it. And then that I gave that sequence to Barnstorm as well. And that was something that I don't think most people will even catch.
No, digital makeup like that is really tricky. I mean, it has to be faultless, because of course, what are we looking at? The actress's face.
Yeah. Same with the clothes. I mean, because once again, it was a top and then the pants and then even her shoes, they added all sorts of like grime and dirt to it around her knees and stuff like that, using the reference of the other shots. But yeah, so there was a bunch of like invisible type work in it. And even the big sequence in one, that SSVFX, that really wasn't supposed to be that big of a sequence. That bit where Creasy's walking from Mello's car to see the remains of the building, that was all supposed to be done on location, but we kept running into weather problems, rain and lightning. So twice the shoot had been postponed, and then it was finally determined, okay, you know what? We're just going to film it against blue screen and it'll become visual effects. And so that's what we ended up doing. Locations in Mexico City found this kind of like unused building. It was not a stage by any means. It was just an empty building. They dressed it in blue screen and we shot it, but the blue screens were literally like 10 feet from people. This was a small, small area.
And yeah.
We had to make it look like it was twice as long as it was.
I guess the only thing you had going for you there is it was at night, right? Because if it had been daylight, it would have been a nightmare to kind of get the lighting.
Yeah. I mean, the whole area, I mean, there's digital crowds added to that behind them, behind the building extensions. We had to extend a whole city block or more to those sequence. So yeah, it's one of those ones that most people don't realize we had done anything other than the two final
great
shots.
Great work though.
No, thank you.
Great, good, really good work. Hey, thanks so much, Kevin, for talking to us about it. We really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime.
And congrats on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks so much, Kevin, for taking the time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. And that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.